From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Mountain View.
San Rafael.
Lower Haight, San Francisco.
Brentwood.
Corte Madera.
Pleasant Hill.
Inner Richmond in San Francisco.
Montclair in Oakland.
Coming up, we'll spend some time looking at the rise of the sharing economy.
That's the basic fundamental building block of all economics, is that we are selfish. What happens if you turn that around and say, well, actually, maybe people want to be selfless?
We'll see how sharing economy ideas are turning good deeds into good business.
One estimate puts the investment that's flowed in over the last 4 or 5 years at $2 billion.
And how this type of transaction can also have a positive impact on our environment and our collective conscience.
Taking the time to go in my community, use this way to meet people and really get outside of the money system really brings me a lot of fulfillment.
Sharing's caring, today on an extended edition of Cross Currents. People sharing their stuff with others is nothing new. Human beings have been exchanging and bartering since the dawn of history. But in recent years, the internet has helped the so-called sharing economy reach new heights. Car shares, bike shares, Facebook, YouTube, Craigslist, all of our lives are being affected by this shift in one way or another. And a lot of the new way we share is happening here in the Bay Area. So today, we want to look at the current state of the sharing economy, where it came from, and where it's going.
It's always more fun to share with everyone.
No coercion, no compulsion, just purely for the spirit of generosity.
Hey, Bert, would you share that half a cookie with me?
Sharing is hard sometimes for everyone, isn't it?
Instead of saying, what can I get, what can I give?
If you have three. And here to help us explore this is KALW's Jen Sheehan. Welcome.
Hi, Ben. Glad to be here.
So, Jen, you've been doing a bulk of the reporting on the sharing economy for us. Could you tell us a little bit about the stories you've done?
Yeah. So I profiled a bilingual community bike shop in East Oakland called Colectivalo. And I did a story about a donation-based dance event in Berkeley called Soul Sanctuary. And then one about an alternative economic system based on exchanging time instead of money, which we'll be hearing later in the show. And, you know, as I explored the different ideas and companies sprouting up around the concept of sharing, I realized that there were some common threads emerging, but there was also still a lot of trial and error going on.
Right. So is there any way of knowing where this sharing trend kind of started?
Well, if anyone could answer that, I think it's Neil Gorenflot. He's the co-founder and publisher of the online magazine Shareable.net. I met up with him to get his perspective on how the sharing economy has evolved, and I asked him that very question.
The sharing economy, or the idea of sharing, has risen because of opportunity and crisis. So we're in, both an economic and an environmental crisis. We've reached our limits in some ways, I feel, or at least there's some signs of that. And so sharing is a way another way that we can go. You know, instead of prosperity through growth, we can go towards prosperity through sharing.
So would you say that this new version of the sharing economy started around the recession or was spurred by the recession?
Yeah, and the other thing is not only do you have the motivation to share, but also the means now with wide adoption of smartphones and the internet, right? So we have the means and the motivation, very powerful, both very powerful drivers. And yeah, I would say that this idea, this resurgence in interest and the labeling of it, the sharing economy, came out, yeah, definitely out of the recession of around 2008, 2007. We launched in 2009. And we launched with the idea that...
And when you say we, you mean Shareable.
We mean Shareable, yeah, the nonprofit. We started Shareable with the question, you know, how do we start a movement for sharing? And then when we did the research, we were like, oh my goodness, they're like, it's breaking out, you know, or about to break out all over the place. We saw all of these trends, all of these new things emerging where sharing was the common thread. And we're like, no, we don't need to start a movement. We need to accelerate or, right, catalyze.
Can you describe the different incarnations of the sharing economy? So it seems to be an umbrella term for a lot of different things.
Yeah. So Shareable, we define it very broadly, which is a little bit different than the mainstream media, which will talk about the sexy technology stuff, you know, like Airbnb, you know, which is peer-to-peer accommodation. and Sidecar and Lyft, which is ride sharing and peer-to-peer car sharing, relay rides and get around, for instance. And that tends to get labeled the sharing economy in the mainstream media, but we see the sharing economy as much broader, encompassing things like open source software, the cooperative movement, you know, all the open X movements, open education. And so we see it as a, something where everyone's needs are met within ecological bounds. So there's a sort of social justice or fairness element to it. But we didn't want to kind of use those old terms that are kind of part of a left-right sort of black-and-white thinking about politics. The movement that we see is not left- or right-oriented, that actually combines elements from both sides of the political spectrum, both the idea of a free market, but also fairness and access.
So you've been observing the sharing economy through Shareable since 2009. What do you think has changed since then in that time?
Well, the public dialogue has changed quite a bit, and it started out to be more public, I think, public interest oriented, and focused more on it as a lifestyle, kind of a lifestyle choice and something, the informal aspects of it. And now has evolved, a lot of money has flowed into it. And so this more typical sort of startup rhetoric and thinking around it is more prevalent now. Yeah.
Was there a particular company or way of sharing that was a game changer?
Yeah, I think, you know, it depends on the timing. I mean, Zipcar certainly was really important, became the largest car sharing organization in the world, and mainstreamed the idea, at least, even though it's still relatively small user base. And so the idea of sharing cars, that's a huge shift to think about for Americans, because cars are so iconic and we're you know, it's tied to our identity, and a big piece of the consumer economy revolves around, you know, cars and car spend, things around they spend around cars. And then, you know, Airbnb came around, and now we started talking about sharing our homes. And so here, the two, I think, linchpins of the consumer economy, I would say, you know, the majority of consumer spending is, you know, somehow tied to cars and homes, right? And so when you start to change those ideas of how we consume those or how we share those assets, then, you know, the consumer economy starts to pivot.
That's Neil Gorenflot. He's publisher of Shareable.net. It's an online magazine about the sharing economy. He was speaking with KALW's Jen Sheehan, and we'll return to hear more of their conversation later in this show. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. Jen is actually here in studio with me today as we discuss the past, the present, and the future of the sharing economy.
That's right. And as you just heard Neil Gorenflot say, companies like Zipcar and Airbnb really shifted our ideas about how we own or share things like our cars and our apartments. But there are many different ways that people practice sharing. A lot of the time, it's about exchanging. So I give you this, and then you give me that. But sometimes people decide to share without expecting anything back.
One of the most prominent thinkers in that style of sharing is Nipun Mehta. To describe it, he came up with the phrase giftivism.
If you look at economics, right, it's built on the premise that people aim to maximize self-interest. That's the basic fundamental building block of all economics, is that we are selfish. What happens if you turn that around and say, well, actually, maybe people want to be selfless?
That's Mehta speaking at a TEDx conference in Berkeley in 2012. Back in 1999, he founded a nonprofit that would create social service projects based on this crazy idea that people will do things for each other for free. The organization is called Service Space, and one of its most well-known projects is called Karma Kitchen.
The Karma Kitchen launched in Berkeley back in 2007. And the idea was to have a regular day at a local restaurant where the guests would receive food or drink at no charge. all of it would be paid for by previous patrons. They might then choose to pay something ahead for the next person or not. KALW's Mary Reese has more about that in this story from our archives.
Snappy's Cafe in Hayward is usually a good place to grab a quick cup of coffee or maybe a pastry before heading to work. Either could run you anywhere from $1.50 to $3. But on the third Sunday of every month, Snappy's transforms. Today, the menu consists of refreshing coconut juice, a South Indian snack called idli, and eggplant chutney. It's all provided by a local Indian caterer and served by volunteers. Shruti Hegde is one of them, and she treats people as if she were in her own living room.
Everybody who walks in, they're our personal guests, like the way we would welcome any guest at home, and we would serve them exactly the way that, you know, we would serve them at a home.
And the check that patrons get after this meal, no matter what they ate, shows the same amount, $0.00.
It's totally for community building, and that's what we want to do here.
Welcome to Karma Kitchen. It's not a physical place, it's more like a practice. Even though it's small, it's growing in a handful of cities, including Washington and Chicago, as well as in India and Japan. On a weekly or monthly basis, customers receive a meal free of charge, and they can opt to donate something or not to keep the gift moving along to the next person. Volunteer Sandy Frost says this is a lot like
somebody paying ahead for you at the toll plaza, you know, when you come up to the bridge and you get to go for free because the car ahead of you has paid in advance.
Frost and Hegde met while working on a neighborhood garden together.
I was searching for what I wanted as a more traditional practice here close to home, and I found it. And it's just been wonderful. I've been practicing with them for 2 years.
Hegde got involved with Karma Kitchen when it began at Taste of the Himalayas in Berkeley. It was started by Service Space, an organization that promotes volunteerism as a way to counterbalance what drives our economy.
You know, people are taken by the simplicity of the idea, because the hardest thing about it isn't fundraising or a business plan. It's love, right? It's believing in people's fundamental generosity.
That's Nipun Mehta, founder of Service Space and the first Karma Kitchen. He understands why business owners may consider it risky, so that's why volunteers pay rent to use their space.
We cover all their costs for the day, so the restaurant isn't making much of a sacrifice, you know. It's actually got everything to gain. But it just feels like a foreign idea, you know, for people to like, wow, okay, do I really want to try that? You know, what is that and what's going to come out of it? What kind of clientele will it attract to my restaurant, you know, and what? So there's a lot of questions that will come up, but financial isn't one of them.
In fact, guests of Karma Kitchen remember the host restaurant and they go back on other days. The owner of Taste of the Himalayas, where it started, observed a benefit.
He then saw that all the other days he was hitting record traffic, and he himself would say that he made more money in a down economy than he's made ever before.
Mehta says our individual consumer-based culture has cheapened human relationships, and that projects like Karma Kitchen counter that.
Money inherently builds a system of scarcity, where there isn't enough and we're all competing for that. And that ends up being a motivation to get people to do work. But is there a higher motivation that isn't rooted in scarcity? And maybe it's a hybrid, but we owe it to ourselves as a culture to keep that part of the spectrum alive. And if we don't do that, then we're going to lose sensitivity to all those things and, you know, degrade ourselves into a lesser human experience.
Back in Hayward, Mehta's message makes sense to April Yamaguchi. She's the owner of Snappy's Cafe. She first got involved after seeing Karma Kitchen in action in Berkeley, and she was asked to host one at Snappy's after the Berkeley Kitchen became inactive. Yamaguchi says she sees the benefits beyond her bottom line.
I think, you know, we contribute to be a part of the community. So maybe the dollar amount coming in today to us may not be a big amount, but more people would know about Karma Kitchen, more people would know about Snappy's. The business is one part, and yes, it is important so that we can have the lights on tomorrow and another Karma Kitchen going on next month, but it's more than the business part.
Even though the spirit of Karma Kitchen is to receive and then give what you can, it's totally possible to eat and never donate to the program. Volunteer Shruti Hegde admits that she saw that happen occasionally at Berkeley's Karma Kitchen.
There are some people who only come for that, but for that, we know, you know, like, we have to shower them with more generosity, more abundance. But once, you know, we explain them everything, they experience the gift, and they know that this is a gift that, you know, people are giving them, something happens in them, some inner transformation, you know?
I try to be as positive as I can, because it's a great thing.
Ninth grader Jiarun Chen came by to see how he could volunteer in the future. He says it's really about spreading a good attitude.
It makes other people happy. It makes me happy. It makes our society and our community overall better. Because if you be negative to another person, how would they feel? And how are they going to react to the next person they see?
The positive effects of these transactions can't be measured in dollars and cents. But good karma really is a long-term investment. For Cross Currents, I'm Mary Reese.
That story originally aired in 2012. We want to know, do you pay it forward in your own life? Tell us about it on our tip line. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney.
And I'm Jen Sheehan.
All right, Jen, so let's go back now to your conversation with Neil Gorenflot from Shareable.net.
All right. So sharing sounds like a great idea. It's something that we teach kids to do in kindergarten. But when these new economic ideas start hitting the status quo, he told me that there's bound to be some bumps in the road.
We have seen all kinds of institutional barriers for sharing across the board, you know, from sharing cars and sharing rides to sharing food and sharing our homes and our real estate.
Can you describe or explain one or two examples of institutional barriers to some of this?
Yeah, for instance, with peer accommodation, you know, opening up your home to short-term rentals in many cities is, you know, illegal. The don't allow, there's, you know, a couple of different things. First, there's taxation that you should be paying, hotel tax. We had that issue in San Francisco. There's zoning issues. There's health code issues. You know, with also ride sharing, sidecar and Lyft, both have had, were issued cease and desist orders in San Francisco because it didn't really fit into the existing regulations. They were thinking about it like taxi cabs and other regulated forms of transportation. Existing rules didn't factor in the emergence of this new way of getting around where we, you know, provide rides for each other.
Other than some of these vested interests, as you said, like hotels or existing taxi drivers, are there other critics of the sharing economy expanding more?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hitting the mainstream as an idea. And so there is a sort of backlash. And I just got a call today from a reporter who was writing a story on the dark side of the sharing economy, right? So I think it's pretty natural for their, you know, something that gets really hyped and also rubs against the grain of our culture in some important ways, that there, I'm surprised there hasn't been more, you know, frankly. So yeah, you'll probably see more of that. And I think it's healthy, for us to have this kind of discussion.
Do you think there's a dark side to the sharing economy?
Well, let me put it this way, is that there's a dark side to everything, but the dark side to the economy that we're in now, we know it, and it's significant and threatens our species. It's I think, way outweighs the dark side that sharing would bring.
Do you have any examples of any time the sharing economy has gone wrong or lessons learned from not doing things quite right?
Yeah, I mean, a personal example is before there were services where you could do this easily, I shared my car with my roommates, And it ended up in the impound lot in San Francisco with a parking violation and a kind of unfortunate series of things. And so that was a share fail. So there was a luxury, I'm forgetting the name, but there was a luxury car sharing, peer-to-peer car sharing company that didn't have the right security for their system and had to shut down because some criminals targeted them and stole a lot of their inventory. And so that was the end of their service. It's all in how you design this design systems. I mean, for instance, Airbnb now has identity verification where you can do it online and you like scan in your like driver's license or your passport. And so it's, the amount of security and the different ways of ensuring trust, they're getting more sophisticated and better all the time. So I think just like anything that's new, you know, you've got to work out the kinks and there's going to be some hiccups.
That's Neil Gorenflot of Shareable.net speaking with KALW's Jen Sheehan, who's with us in studio today. I'm Ben Trefney. You're listening to Cross Currents.
We'll hear the rest of my conversation with Neil Gorenflot in a little bit. But first, I wanted to share a piece that I reported about a radically different approach to the sharing economy. So far, we've heard about exchanging goods or services, and you can even exchange cash, like at Karma Kitchen, where the idea is to pay it forward for the next patron. Well, in this next example, time is literally money.
It's called the Bay Area Community Exchange Time Bank. Jen went to go look at the San Francisco branch of the project to see how it really works in this piece from our archives.
Frida Kapar Bay is an herbalist, and today she's giving a workshop on growing your own herbs for medicinal use.
And this plant does amazing things for fractures, torn ligaments, broken bones, anything like that.
A class like this might normally cost $50 to $60, but today, these students have not paid one dime. We're at the Homestead Skillshare Festival at Hayes Valley Farm in San Francisco. This day-long gathering, which includes 40 different workshops, food, and live entertainment, is being funded with a different kind of currency, ours. These transactions go through something called the Bay Area Community Exchange Time Bank.
Everybody's hour is equal. So, for example, I do an hour of massage for somebody, and then I get an hour credit to then get an hour of plumbing from somebody else. If I spend 2 hours, then I get 2 hours credit, and so on.
That's Mira Luna, a founder and organizer of the Time Bank. With the hectic nature of city life, and given today's tough economy, Luna says the Time Bank makes good financial sense. But she says it's also about building trust through personal interactions.
In fact, money is really often very anonymous, and we can't tell where that money has traveled, how people have earned it, whether they've earned it in integrity or through exploitation. But you can actually tell where all of your hours were earned on the Time Bank. It's all very transparent.
John Troutwine, who paid 2 hours to attend the festival today, appreciates the community-building aspect of the Time Bank. He says he's earned most of his hours by giving rides to people.
You're building a community, which is like, if I think about what life really means to me, it's more about taking the time to go in my community and use this way to meet people and really get outside of the money system. Really brings me a lot of fulfillment.
While the Time Bank may seem like a new concept, it's actually kind of a throwback. During the Great Depression, Oakland had an unemployed exchange association. It helped thousands of members meet basic needs without the use of money. Our own Great Recession has inspired modern approaches to this idea, like ride shares and donation-based services. What makes today's sharing economy different from previous generations is access to the mother of all marketplaces, the internet.
It kind of is a mix between Facebook and Craigslist with a reputation system kind of built in.
Mira Luna's profile on the Time Bank website includes her photo and bio and lists all of her past exchanges, along with short comments or thank yous.
It says, Mira Luna paid Denise Minter 1.0 hours for wonderful Qigong class. Somebody else paid me for 1.3 hours thanks for the pachos dinner, which is potato nachos.
Along with showing what kinds of services someone has given or received, the comments also act as a kind of review system.
And those are considered just as valuable as the hours because people can read those on your profile, just like a Yelp review, and see how good you were with your service, how friendly you were, and so on. And so that kind of builds your reputation.
Luna says these reviews are essential for successful use of the time bank.
Just like most transactions with money are done online and are just digital, and they're backed by trust, essentially trust in the federal government, ours is backed by trust in community.
Luna says there's only been one real problem over the 2.5 years the time bank has been operating. A dispute over a missed appointment turned contentious, which resulted in a member voluntarily leaving the time bank.
You can't really get rich, you know, off time dollars. You can't buy a house in Hawaii or a fancy car. So there's no point in trying to, you know, manipulate people through the system. And it's very transparent again. So if anybody's doing anything wrong, it becomes immediately obvious.
But just like with any other bank, sticky situations do come up, like going into debt. The time bank allows for users to receive more hours than they give, up to 25, before it flags the system. That flag will prompt time bank administrators to contact the member to see if they need help spending or earning, but they won't stop that person's account.
We just try and help them balance things out if they want to. And other members will see where their balance is and make a decision based on that. So if somebody is very much in debt and there's no reason for it, then other members probably won't transact with them. But we leave it up to them.
Time Bank member John Troutwine says he's not convinced that people can handle these kinds of issues without explicit checks and balances in the system.
It is easy to start spending money you don't have. That's such already part of our culture anyways with like credit cards and other like things that I think it doesn't necessarily breed a lot of consciousness with how you spend money. It's like, I mean, it's funny because it's time and it is this like alternative economic system, but I think it still is going to come up with the same exact challenges that our current economic system has, because in the end it still is an economic system.
Despite these possible issues, Luna says she hopes to see alternative economic models like the time bank become more prevalent, but she's also realistic about their place in the current economy.
To the extent that, you know, people drop out of the mainstream system and stop supporting national corporate businesses, then we'll be able to use the time bank more. But it is dependent on that.
Back at the Homestead Skillshare Festival, you can find plenty of folks who are trying to be less dependent on these mainstream systems. A make-your-own sauerkraut class is now taking place.
It's us teaming with the microorganisms to create an environment where the beneficial microorganisms have an opportunity and an environment where they can thrive.
Around the festival, others are learning how to draw their own maps, build an outdoor oven, and to power an ice cream maker with a bicycle. And luckily, the only currency accepted here is one that everyone has.
That story originally aired in 2012. To hear more stories about the local sharing economy or to subscribe to our podcast, go to kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. And I'm joined by reporter Jen Sheehan, who's been helping us today as we explore the past, the present, and the future of the sharing economy.
We're going to go back now to my conversation with Neil Gorenflo, publisher of the online magazine Shareable.net. We're talking about what it means to participate in this alternative economy. I asked him what's next as this movement gains momentum. Will it grow beyond the Bay Area? And he told me that it already has.
There's a worldwide boom in bike sharing going on, and that was really catalyzed by the Vélib system in Paris in 2007. They kind of cracked the code for bike sharing in the city, and that has spread, and it's bike sharing is the fastest growing form of public transportation. Also in Europe, city-to-city ride sharing is unbelievably robust experience in business right now. So there's two main players there, BlaBlaCar and Carpooling.com, and they do millions of rides per month, people going between different European cities. In the developing world, sharing is an everyday part of life. They don't talk about it. It's woven into the culture.
Where do you think the sharing economy is headed? Is there a particular area that still needs innovating or an area that hasn't been explored yet?
I think it's going to head into virtually, and already is in some ways, heading into just about every area. Like, you know, education, healthcare is a lot of innovation already happening. And the higher ed is in particular seems to be in a state of crisis. And so we're in a kind of, renaissance or period of rapid innovation in education. I think healthcare, there's a lot of opportunities there. And stuff like childcare. We did an informal nanny share, and we saved like $10,000 by sharing childcare with other families in the neighborhood. It's really practical. I think the maker movement, for instance, is very, very important. One of the things that's happening is energy prices are going up, and production, the cost of certain production equipment is plummeting. And so the chance for just an ordinary individual to become a kind of one-person manufacturer is and do what only a big corporation could do just a few years ago is now a reality. So you could, go on the internet and use Bright Idea or user voice and like brainstorm with your community for to get an idea, take that idea and prototype it at Tech Shop, like actually build a prototype. Tech Shop is an open access machine shop. Then you fund the prototype on Kickstarter, find a contract manufacturer, go into production, sell it on Etsy, or pick your Amazon, eBay, pick your marketplace. So you can do the whole thing from ideation to prototyping to funding to sales and marketing and do it all on the internet.
So as the sharing economy does expand into more sectors, how is that affecting the mainstream economy or the economy as a whole?
Well, let's take, for instance, car sharing and the impact that it has. Here's the stats on car sharing. So one shared car replaces up to 13 owned cars. 50% of people who join to get access to a car who didn't already have access to a car. Right. So here's a thing that can dramatically reduce resource consumption, but also increase access to the resource at the same time. That's the beauty of sharing. That to add to that, this was a UC Berkeley study that those statistics from. For a separate study showed that if you take 15,000 cars off the ownership rolls in a city, a city could keep $127 million in the local economy annually. Because, 80% of car spending on cars goes outside the economy, to car companies, oil companies, insurance companies, et cetera. So I think that this definitely shifts economic power more to the individual, more to the local economy, and that the implications are for, the biggest implications are for, incumbent large multinationals, which, are in the business of reducing the reliance on human labor as much as possible, so are not the future for individuals. And I think cities are really important to this shift to sharing. I mean, cities are designed in a way to be shared. They're platforms for sharing. And, for the first time ever in human history, there's more people living in cities than not, and also more people with a cell phone than not. And this offers, I think, a really important opportunity to really shift our economy towards something that's sustainable and also that includes everyone, that everyone can get their needs met. And there's a kind of burgeoning movement right now to address that. Here in San Francisco, we have the Sharing Economy Working Group that Shareable helped launch with Mayor Ed Lee. And then also there's, a group forming in New York, in Seoul, Korea, has a very impressive program put together to get behind that idea. And a sort of competition among cities is just getting started, but a very healthy competition to be the best places to share on the planet.
And the investment world is supporting all of this, right? There's been a lot of investing in sharing companies and this kind of thing.
Yes. One estimate puts it, the investment that's flowed in over the last 4 or 5 years at around $2 billion. So a significant amount of investment has gone in, for sure. You know, there are some analysts who see it just as extension of business as usual. And, you know, we're a nonprofit, we're an advocate for the public. And so we see it as a chance for something radically more more fulfilling and fair, and also less environmentally destructive. So that's, you know, that's our role in the conversation, is to try to drive things in that direction.
That was Neil Gorenflot. He's publisher of Shareable.net, an online magazine that discusses all things sharing economy. He spoke with Jen Sheehan, who joined us today for our Sharing Economy show. Thanks, Jen.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Tiffany Kamhai, Lisa Carmack, Audrey Dilling, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Teddy Lederer, Leah Rose, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Eva Sansin. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, KALW is independent, listener-supported public radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffney.
Cross Currents on KALW 91.7. Somebody tell me, what do we believe in here?
Ultimately, I believe in humans.
Yes, but what else? What do we do at Cross Currents?
It follows a sort of a phonological progression.
Kind of.
You have all this technical equipment and you look like an astronaut, and so people are already looking at you weird.
Bingo. Tune in weekdays at 5 on KALW 91.7. We may look weird, but, well, that's why we're in radio.
The same dead end street.